You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas. As I record this, we are in month 9 of the genocide in Gaza, soon to be month 10. I don't know about you, but at this historical moment, I'm in a bit of a malaise. I don't feel much of anything these days. Now, I don't mean I feel pessimistic or despondent. No, no, no. I don't feel anything. It is as if, at a certain point, this genocide has broken my emotional compass
towards Palestinian liberation.
I bear witness.
See you next week.
I talk about it. But my feelings and affect have gotten flatter and flatter as the violence continues and escalates. So this week, I felt so seen when I caught a live episode of Dispatches from Breakthrough News. They were talking about just that. Why are we numb at month 9 of the genocide in Gaza? What's that about? And shaking ourselves out of the numbness with a conscious assessment of where things are at. And the person doing this assessment was Moin Rabbani with Rania Khalik. I couldn't ask for a better pair of people to take on this historical moment than these two. For those of you who don't know, Moin Rabbani is a Palestinian of Dutch extraction, and he is a very well-published analyst and commentator on Palestinian affairs, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and many other aspects of the contemporary Middle East. He has been a senior Middle East analyst and special advisor on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group. He has also been the head of political affairs with the Office of the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria. He is currently bringing his immense expertise to us in an e-zine called Jadaleya, where he is a co-editor. I go on Jadaleya and Twitter daily, specifically to look at what Moin is saying, because the amount of expertise and integrity he brings to analyzing the current situation is simply unparalleled. He has been all over the media talking about the current situation in Gaza, and rightfully so. But I was so happy to catch him doing this particular show and doing it live, talking about a 9-month assessment of the situation in Gaza. We have a lot to listen to, so yalla bina, let's go. Dispatches is a global interview show hosted by Rania Khadek for Breakthrough News. Rania is one of my favorite journalists. The title of this episode is Israel Wants the World to Become Numb and Distracted, but the Genocide is Ongoing. Rania Khadek is a Lebanese-American writer, political activist, and journalist. She does a lot of work for Breakthrough News, but her work has also appeared all over the place and can be centrally found at her website, raniakhadek.com. She normally pre-records Dispatches, but I love the live back and forth she has here with Moin. She's in Lebanon and loses power at some point, and it affects the interview not at all, which shows you what a pro Rania is. With that, here's Rania and Moin.
Before we get into some more specifics, I'm just curious, what are your thoughts now that we've passed the 9-month mark in this genocide? Did you think it was going to go on this long?
No, I didn't. And I, of course, expected the West to stand four square behind Israel, particularly as it has been doing. And but, you know, if you look at previous conflicts, there was really little indication that it would persist for almost a year, as it has done now, without either Israel becoming too exhausted to continue, or the West recognizing that its own interests are increasingly at stake and calling a halt to Israel's offensive, or indeed that the Palestinians would at a certain point just collapse and lose the ability to continue to resist Israeli aggression. But what we've seen is, on the one hand, the Palestinians proving to be much more effective in resisting Israeli aggression than I think many of us had anticipated. And here, let me just say, the Gaza Strip is 365 square kilometers. It's only marginally larger than the Caribbean island of Grenada, which the United States under Reagan invaded in 1983. Grenada had a regular army, it had a contingent of Cuban military advisors, and it took the US, I think, all of 36 hours to seize control of Grenada in its entirety and eliminate its leadership and so on. Here we have Hamas, which is Israel's weakest adversary in the region, fighting in the smallest territory among Israel's adversaries and being able to hold out for 9 full months. I do think the Israeli military and Israeli society is showing increasing signs of strain and dislocation and all the rest of it. But I think perhaps what we insufficiently accounted for is how far to the right Israeli politics and society have shifted, particularly during the past decade, which makes kind of their determination to fulfill this genocide stand above any costs that they bear for doing so. And I think the other aspect that needs to be specified is the continued unwavering, uncritical support of the Biden administration, with the Europeans and the Brits, of course, ultimately tagging along. I can't imagine any other U.S. administration, whether Democratic or Republican, having the same level of indulgence for Israel that we have seen this past year by the trio of Biden, Blinken, Sullivan, well, let's add McGurk and a few others to that. But they basically will brook absolutely no limits, no opposition to their fanatic determination to stand behind Israel through thick and thin. There have, of course, been several instances where they have tried to push Israel in a different direction, but this hasn't gone beyond expressing verbal opposition, hoping that it changes something in the Israeli political equation. And when it doesn't, and Israel either pushes back or ignores the U.S. admonition, we've repeatedly seen the U.S. position simply collapse and get in line behind Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, and the rest of that gang.
I mean, yeah, I think that that's a really good point and a good segue when we mentioned the American role here. I do want to bring it very, you know, just briefly to the sort of U.S. clown show that we're witnessing right now. And I want to play a clip here that's been making the rounds of Joe Biden. I know you've seen it. Probably many people who are watching have seen it. Oh, sorry if there was some tech issues there.
I couldn't hear the audio. Was that the clip? I'm saying no.
Oh, I'm so sorry if people can hear that. I don't know what the deal was. Sorry, StreamYard. My apologies. That was a StreamYard issue. Yeah, that was Biden saying that he's done more for the Palestinian cause than anybody else. I'm curious what your thoughts are, first of all, on Biden saying that, but also let's bring it to the Democrats for a moment. Do you think, as we witness Biden, you know, oversee this horrific genocide while also somehow claiming to do more for the Palestinian people than anybody else, do you think that we still have a duty to vote for Biden and Democrats to prevent Trump's election, despite his disgusting support for this genocide? Because that's what we're hearing, that we have to vote for Biden and the Democrats, otherwise we are enabling fascism. Mm-hmm.
Well, essentially, you're asking me to choose between lung cancer and brain cancer. And when I tell you that I prefer not to be afflicted with either condition, you're then holding me responsible for the result. I think, you know, that question should not be addressed. First of all, I should say, I'm not an American, so voting or not voting is an issue that's irrelevant to me. But you know, when you ask people to make a choice between two unpalatable possibilities, I think they are perfectly entitled to refuse to choose. And in this particular instance, and given the way that the issue has been presented, I think the onus is very much on the Democrats to present an alternative, to prevent an option that people are prepared to accept. You know, you can't go to voters and say you have to vote for the genocidal candidate, because if you don't, you're going to get a fascist one. Who in their right mind is going to make an informed choice between lung cancer and brain cancer? It's simply not going. It's simply not going to happen. And I think you know, it's the Democrats who have decided to leave people with no option but to abstain from voting, or to sit out the election, or perhaps to vote for a third party candidate, or the Republican candidate, or whatever. And what it shows, essentially, is that the Democratic establishment is prepared to hand the U.S. government over to Donald Trump in order to defend Israel. That's really what's happening here. There are, of course, other issues. You know, Biden's control of the process and so on. But let's be clear: he can be forced out in a week if that's a decision that's taken. But it's been decided that those who are sufficiently disturbed, outraged, enraged, whatever you want to call it, by Biden's foreign policy are not going to be given an option they're prepared to vote for, even at the cost of handing the election to Trump.
I think that's a really great way to frame it, as you're choosing between two kinds of horrible cancers. So in that sense, does it matter who wins? And if it, you know, if so, in what ways would it matter? And I'm just curious, since we recently saw the news about Donald Trump choosing his vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, if you have any thoughts on that particular choice in vice presidential candidate and what a Trump-Vance presidency, which seems more and more likely, might look like for the region.
Well, from what I've seen of Vance, he's one of these typical U.S. isolationists. In other words, does not support an activist foreign policy or throwing billions of dollars at foreign governments, of course, with the exception of Israel. When it comes to Israel, he's indistinguishable from the rest of the U.S. political elite and establishment. He might give different reasons for doing the same thing, but at the end of the day, he does the same thing. I'll limit my response to your question to foreign policy, and particularly the Middle East. Of course, there are many other dimensions that I won't get into. But I think we need to understand that U.S. Middle East policy is determined by the U.S. and not by Israel, is formulated in a way that the U.S. elites understand it to serve U.S. interests, and that the key role in formulating these policies is done by institutions rather than individuals. So if you look at Trump's tenure between 2016 and 2020, you look at all the decisions he took on the U.S. embassy, its location, on the recognition of Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem, on recognition of Israel's claims of sovereignty, rather, over the occupied Syrian Golan Heights and all the rest of it. This was presented as a radical break with traditional U.S. policy. But in fact, it was a logical culmination of policies that had been increasingly pursued de facto by previous administrations, whether Democratic or Republican, and in fact conformed to U.S. law in terms of legislation that had been repeatedly passed with an overwhelming bipartisan consensus by the U.S. Congress. So then you get Biden. Well, did Biden reverse Trump's relocation of the U.S. embassy? No. Did he reverse Trump's recognition of Israel's claims of sovereignty over Jerusalem? No. Did he reverse U.S. recognition of Israel's claims of sovereignty over the occupied Syrian Golan Heights? He did not. Did he reverse Trump's recognition of Morocco's claims of sovereignty over the Western Sahara? Quite the contrary. He reconfirmed it. And not only that, he tried to take Trump's most important initiative, Arab-Israeli normalization, not at the conclusion of a peace process, but as an alternative to resolving the question of Palestine, took it to the next level and invested all his efforts into seeking Saudi-Israeli normalization, which for a number of reasons, I believe, was a non-starter to begin with. But that's a separate discussion. And so when we talk about the next U.S. administration, whether it's a second Biden administration or a second Trump administration, I think we should not only focus on the individuals concerned, but we also need to understand a process that has been developing organically, and that for the most part, I don't think when it comes to U.S. policy towards this region, that there will be as big a distinction between Trump and Biden as people assume. I mean, to give another example, Iran. Of course, yes, a nuclear agreement was reached under the Obama administration. Trump unilaterally renounced this international agreement. Did Biden rejoin it? He did not, you know. And so there will be differences depending on who's at the helm. But we can already see, I think, some changes in the region, which, as you suggested, that Trump is increasingly likely to win this election. Well, you're not the only one who believes that. You have leaders throughout the region who believe that as well. And they are already, let's say, withholding certain policies that they feel would help Biden win the election, either because they prefer a second Trump administration or because they think this will ingratiate them with Trump after he wins. So why give it to a lame duck when you can give it to someone who's going to be there for the next four, or for all we know, the next 40 years? So that's kind of the current situation as I see it.
I want to move to the media because I think it's so interesting that, and that's interesting is an understatement, but I think it's quite interesting that, you know, last week we saw this report from Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, essentially confirming what's already been reported by other Israeli outlets, by some other alternative media outlets in the West, that Israel on October 7th instituted on a mass scale what they termed the Hannibal Directive, which is an Israeli military policy that essentially gives the Israelis permission to shoot, to kill soldiers, to prevent their capture, to be used as hostages, to prevent their enemies from having leverage in prisoner exchanges. The Israelis have used this policy in the past. However, October 7th is the first time we've seen it used on a grand scale against essentially Israeli civilians. And so we've known this. Those of us who've been following the story have known this. The media in the U.S. has been completely silent about it. But it was incredibly surprising because Haaretz has this article essentially backing it all up with Israeli military communications. And I searched every day since then to see who's covered this, because I know that the editors at these major American media outlets are scanning the Israeli press every morning to see the news from Israel. And the Israeli press, by the way, did cover this Haaretz story in English. A lot of the outlets did. I've only so far seen The Guardian, the British news outlet, The Guardian, cover this. I could be wrong. I might have missed something. The New York Times till now has not. The Washington Post till now has not. You know, I'm waiting to see that CNN investigation. I could go on and on. And I guess, you know, my question for you is, what do you think is behind this radio silence? It's kind of stunning to witness.
Well, it challenges an essential part of the narrative. I mean, the way that the Palestinian attacks of October 7th have been presented is they've effectively been decontextualized from the Israeli-Palestinian context. And, you know, they're repeatedly proclaimed as the single largest murder of Jews since the Holocaust, as if we're in Central Europe and not in the Middle East, as if these people are solely were solely attacked on the basis of their identity as Jews, and has nothing to do with them being Israelis and Israel being in occupation of Palestine, and so on. And so I think it fundamentally challenges the narrative that we have been repeatedly fed by Israel and through Israel by mainstream Western corporate media. You know, the Hannibal Doctrine basically states that a dead Israeli soldier is better than an Israeli POW. And we saw several instances of this in 2014 during Operation Protective Edge, I believe in the Shuja'iyah neighborhood of Gaza City, and in Rafah, where Israel launched massive air and artillery raids in order to prevent the capture of Israeli soldiers, killing dozens of Palestinian civilians in the process. And what happened on October 7th is, as you mentioned, this directive was applied on a mass scale, not only to prevent the capture of soldiers, but also to prevent Israeli civilians from being taken hostage inside the Gaza Strip. And I think what still needs to be determined is what proportion of Israeli casualties, and particularly Israeli civilian casualties in October 7th, can and should be ascribed to the actions of the Israeli military and its Air Force in particular, as opposed to Palestinian militants. I think it's an unanswered question. Quite clearly, many Israeli civilians were killed by Palestinian militants, but it appears to have been quite exaggerated as well.
Yeah, and then of course this extends into the issue of the mass rape that was being reported as fact, despite hole after hole in this narrative, which has essentially fallen apart. But almost every mainstream media outlet pushed this, trying to justify what Israel's doing in Gaza. I really appreciated the way Arun Gupta wrote about it in Middle East Monitor. In the title, he called it an industrial scale Jim Crow rape hoax, yes, referring, of course, to the fact that during the Jim Crow era, many Black men were lynched on false accusations, not even just of raping white women, but in some cases of whistling at a white woman. And so this is a genocide being justified on a lie. And I just want to clarify, by the way, had something like that happened, it still wouldn't justify a genocide. That said, what's really ironic about all this is there's actual evidence that the Israelis are engaging in the use of sexual assault and rape as a weapon of torture
on a widespread scale.
Yes, in their prisons against those that they've kidnapped from Gaza. The New York Times came out with a really horrific report full of testimonies by Palestinians who've been held at one notorious concentration camp where they've kidnapped Palestinians, where they've been sodomizing men with hot metal sticks and in some cases killing them. I also, real quick, before I finish about the rape hoax, I do want to note, by the way, just to what you were talking about earlier, there was a New York Times report out today. I was reading through it before we started, before we got on this episode, and it was talking about the early June, you know, so-called rescue attempt of those three Israeli hostages when Israel killed almost 300 Palestinians in the process. They destroyed 42 buildings. Damaged or destroyed 42 buildings in that so-called rescue operation. All that's to say, the Israelis are engaging in just mass cruelty. But of course, the irony with a lot of what they're accusing the Palestinians of is that they're the ones engaging in an action.
Every accusation is a confession, as the saying goes.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think with the rape hoax, it's a bit more nefarious than the silence about the Hannibal Directive, because so many media outlets engaged in spreading it. And then we didn't really see any mea culpas. So I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Well, you're not going to see any mea culpas. You know, the New York Times ran this major so-called investigative report, Screams Without Words, which should properly have been entitled Screams Without Evidence. And you know, and Arun Gupta has done wonderful work exposing this hoax, this sham, and just as importantly, I think, placing it in its proper context, which is that when you have congenitally racist societies, such as Israel is with respect to Palestinians and Arabs, nothing mobilizes this racism and this hatred more than attacks on quote unquote our women and girls. And therefore, I think it will become clear that the mass rape hoax was premeditated from the first moment, in the first instance, to mobilize Israeli society in support of the Israeli government and military's subsequent genocidal actions. But then, just as importantly, to mobilize Western support, Western unconditional, uncritical support for Israel's genocidal campaign. And, you know, in the West in recent years, Islamophobia has become flavor of the month. Palestinians are seen as a Muslim population. You already have this very deeply ingrained anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab racism throughout Western elites. And so accusing them of mass rape, you know, is kind of icing on the cake. And it's a bit similar to the babies and incubators story during the Kuwait crisis in 1991. You know, there was very substantial opposition to the buildup to that war. But that story and its endorsement at the time by both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, for which I think Human Rights Watch apologized, but Amnesty never did, that really helped turn the tide in terms of mobilizing popular opinion behind the policies of the US and the UK during that crisis. And I think the mass rape hoax has played a similar role. And when you talk about the media's role, well, you're talking about the same media that systematically promoted the Iraqi WMD hoax, you know, within living memory. And you know, we tend to belittle the Soviet media, the North Korean media, and so on as agents of the state. Well, do these corporate mainstream media really operate all that differently in functioning as a channel for official policy to help mold public opinion? In this particular case, at least the one I'm familiar with, I really don't see that significant of a distinction. And I think, you know, I've been referring to the New York Times as American Pravda, and it seems to lose no opportunity to confirm that assessment.
I want to ask you to talk about something that you've discussed actually quite a bit, which is the ceasefire talks. And in that, I'm specifically talking about the fact that repeatedly we've seen a pattern from the Israelis where there's like movement on the ceasefire talks, you know, and you've even seen compromises by Hamas and, okay, we're willing to do it this way or this way. The Americans will get excited. The Israelis will kind of play along and then suddenly happens to change every, you know, that changes everything and they fall apart. I'm curious if you can talk a bit about that. I know that, you know, since October 7th, there's been maybe a dozen at this point times where ceasefire talks have taken place and then the Israelis have basically scuttled them.
Well, I think the main lesson we've learned is there's only going to be a ceasefire when Joe Biden picks up the phone, calls Netanyahu, and repeats the same statement he communicated to Netanyahu in 2021. Quote, you've run out of road, end quote. and then it will immediately stop, absent the U.S. actually using its enormous leverage that it has with Israel. Well, one thing we've learned in the current crisis is how extraordinarily dependent Israel is on the U.S., militarily, politically, diplomatically, and so on. Absent a clear position by the U.S., it's not going to happen. And by clear position, I don't just mean Washington stating what it wants, but actually walking the walk and ensuring that this happens. If you look at the situation within Israel, it's a little more complicated. Previously, I think the entire security establishment and the entire governing elite, despite their little maneuvers, rejected a ceasefire for the reason that they are responsible for the biggest failure in Israel's admittedly short history on the 7th of October, 2023. There is going to be accountability for their strategic failures. And I think from their perspective, continuing the war in the hope of achieving some kind of strategic success would benefit them when the time for accountability comes. You're now seeing, I think, increasing divisions within the Israeli governing elite. And I think it would be too simplistic to say it's between the government and the security establishment. I mean, there are different factions within each, but there are some who I think are increasingly coming to the realization that you can't continue to throw good money after bad and expect to hit the jackpot. There are others who are looking at how Israel's regional position and posture is weakening with every day, and therefore feel there needs to be put an end to that, or they want to focus very much on a potential conflict in Lebanon. And then, of course, central to all this is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It's often presented as he needs to continue the war to stay in power. I think that's also a very simplistic explanation. Of course he wants to stay in power. But he too, as the person who was in charge of the Israeli ship of state on October 7th, wants to end this in a way that he can say, okay, I may have made a mistake, but look at this enormous achievement. Gaza has been razed to rubble. Hamas has been eradicated. Each of its leaders has been blown to smithereens. The Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip now has no option but either to break into Egypt or make a mad dash across the Mediterranean. So there's that aspect. The other aspect, of course, is that the apocalyptic wing of his government, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, have made very clear that they will bring down the governing coalition if the war ends. And, you know, for them, they don't really care how much cannon fodder is expended. And in fact, they want to not only not end the war in the Gaza Strip, they want to expand it, intensify it in the West Bank, engage in a full-scale war against Lebanon, ideally probably nuke Iran or something. So those are the kinds of calculations that are at play here. And really the only thing that can lead to a breakthrough here is either much greater pressure from the Israeli domestic public, which is growing, but I don't for the present see reaching that level where it has a decisive impact on the Israeli government, or as I mentioned before, Biden picking up the phone saying you've run out of road, which he's really not going to do, I think, anytime soon.
Yeah, Biden seems to be in it till the end. And I think it's a good point you make about the sort of factionalization of Israeli politics. And, you know, I think that when I'm talking to you from Beirut, which, by the way, I saw someone in the comments wondering why my electricity went out. It's because I'm in Beirut and we don't have 24-hour electricity here. And there's a different, it's maybe not funny, but a joke we make in Lebanon is, you know, the Israelis are always threatening to bomb our electricity plants and people will say, okay, like what, unless you want to go bomb all the neighborhood generators.
Which like, they've probably planned for.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe they've got the coordinates. I don't know. But then they're going to have a bunch of neighborhood generator gangs to deal with on their hands. But no, I mean, all that's, of course, in jest. But in all seriousness, you know, you do have obviously segments of the Israeli government who very much want to go to war in the north against Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it's a part of needing that victory narrative as well. On the one hand, there's the, you know, more right-wing fanatical crazies who just want to destroy Lebanon to take more territory. And then there's, you know, the sort of more politically savvy ones who recognize that they need a victory in order to get their people to go back to the north, because right now a significant number of Israelis have left the north because it's being hit by Hezbollah and this kind of tit for tat, and they don't feel comfortable going back because Hezbollah is this big threat, and on and on and on. All that's to say, you know, sometimes when I think about Lebanon and the potential for a broader scale war here, you know, I don't see it breaking out into a bigger war because the Israelis have so much to lose if they provoke a wider war because of how much damage Hezbollah can do to them. But then, you know, sometimes I also wonder, is that resting too much on Israeli rationality? Because yes, there are some rational actors in Israel in the sense of they have some, you know, some semblance of like self-preservationist mentality. But at the same time, what they're doing is also insane for and not sustainable for the future. So I don't really know if they're rational. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on Israel's level of rationality here.
Well, rationality works in mysterious ways. You know, one rational analysis would be to say that if Israel insists on invading Lebanon, it risks transforming its failure in the Gaza Strip. And I think it is a failure, but also not more than a failure, into a strategic defeat in Lebanon and the region. You know, and another rational analysis would say that Israel may be sufficiently confident that if it attacks Lebanon, that Iran will also get involved, and that particularly in the context of a U.S. election year, will force the hand of the Biden administration to become directly engaged and fulfill Israel's longstanding wet dream of a direct military confrontation between the United States and Iran. Look, I'm not a specialist on the Second World War. But I imagine that in 1939 and 1940 and up until the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, you had senior German commanders and perhaps others in the German elite advising Hitler of, you know, the absolute craziness of invading the Soviet Union and transforming it into a two-front war. Well, he did so anyway. And it was the end of the Third Reich. So, you know, we can sit here and talk about how irrational it would be for Israel to invade Lebanon. And I'm sure there are also those in the Israeli security establishment and elites and in the economic elite and so on who feel similar. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Governments take irrational decisions all the time. But I do think that if Israel does invade Lebanon, it will have an exponentially larger problem on its hands than it has had so far. I mean, you look at, for example, Palestinian missile attacks on Israel, particularly between October and December, until they became, you know, much more few and far between. Well, they managed to paralyze daily life in much of central Israel, but the amount of damage that they did on military facilities, infrastructure, and so on was very, very limited because they simply don't have the capacity. Well, Hezbollah is a very different kettle of fish. If Hezbollah begins targeting Israeli military facilities and critical infrastructure, it's not going to survive a Hezbollah onslaught. And even more so, if in response to an Israeli attack on Lebanon, Iran enters the fray. It's to me very unclear whether it will or it won't under such circumstances, because of course it has various other considerations. But will, for example, such a conflict, if it exposes further Israeli weakness, lead to a Syrian attempt to liberate the Golan Heights, or an attempt by others from within Syria? You know, how will the situation develop in countries such as Jordan and Egypt, which have thus far managed to contain popular sentiment and maintain their relationships with Israel? So it opens many, many new cans of worms that you would think anyone with common sense in Israel would advise against. But as we've seen, common sense is in increasingly short supply.
So I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens on the Lebanon front and all the other fronts and see just how insane Israel and their American backers are. I wanted to ask you about another development that we saw recently, which also received very little, if any, mainstream media coverage. And that is this, the fact that we saw this this piece in The Lancet, the most prestigious medical journal in the world, saying that the death toll in Gaza could be as high, if not higher than 186,000 people. And, you know, we've seen this widely repeated death toll of 40,000 in Gaza for months now, because their capacity to actually count the deaths has been wiped out, given the level of destruction across Gaza, especially to its medical infrastructure. So 186,000 people, 7.9% of the total population in Gaza, which is just a wild statistic. And that's a conservative estimate. And again, this news passed with very little attention. And I'm just curious your thoughts on that massive number.
Well, just by way of disclaimer, first of all, the authors of this letter to the editor did not say that this is the actual death toll, but that they make a conservative estimate about the very realistically expected death toll. And second of all, this was a letter to the editor rather than a peer-reviewed article. But having said that, the editors of The Lancet, which, as you mentioned, is arguably the world's most prestigious medical journal, felt this was a sufficient serious examination to publish on their pages. And what the authors of this letter have done is examine the proportion of combat to non-combat fatalities that can be attributed to the armed conflict. And here they are looking at things such as the systematic destruction of the Palestinian health infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, the willful deprivation of food, of medicines, of clean water, and all these other factors. And looking at historically in other conflicts, the proportion between combat and non-combat fatalities and casualties, depending again on these underlying factors, and concluded that under current circumstances, it would be realistic and indeed conservative to estimate that between 7 and 9% of the population of the Gaza Strip will perish as a result of Israel's genocidal policies in the Gaza Strip. And what's interesting here is that a similar study was done in the aftermath of Protective Edge in 2014, which found that the overwhelming majority of Palestinian casualties were combat died as a result of armed hostilities. In other words, if you weren't shot or bombed, you were in that small minority of casualties who died as a result of indirect effects of the war. The difference, of course, is that in 2014, the Gaza Strip still had a health infrastructure. It was still able to generally feed its people and supply them with minimally clean water and so on. The situation now is that many, many people are receiving non-life-threatening wounds that in the context of the Gaza Strip are proving to be fatal. If people dying of malnutrition, you have people unable to get regular medical care that are turning into fatal infections. And of course, you're seeing the rapid spread of communicable diseases such as hepatitis and others. And that's the analysis that's being presented in this letter. But again, you know, it goes against the narrative of heroic little Israel fending off the savage hordes from across its borders. So it's simply ignored.
I wanted to also ask, I mean, one of the wounds people are getting are by attacks by dogs. Yeah. And I raised that because, you know, you recently tweeted some information about one of these attacks. I mean, I think a lot of us saw the story about the Palestinian man with Down syndrome who was literally left to die after by Israeli soldiers after a combat dog attack. And then
dogs were set upon him.
Yes, yes. Which it's not the first time that's happened. The Israelis have been setting dogs on Palestinians. And then you noted that this dog was most likely proudly trained and enthusiastically delivered by the Netherlands. So that was a bit of a twist I wasn't expecting. Could you explain what you meant by that? Yeah.
Well, according to available reporting, Israel acquires most of its combat dogs from the Netherlands and where else? Germany. And the Four Winds canine combat dog breeder in the Netherlands, in fact, proudly advertises that for 20 years, it has been the main supplier of such dogs to the Israeli military. It also claims to be the main exporter of such dogs to Africa and the Middle East more generally. There appear to be absolutely no export restrictions on these kinds of exports to the Israeli army, just as Europe effectively places no import restrictions on products from illegal Israeli settlements. There was a case, I believe in 2017, where a Palestinian boy who was deliberately mauled by two of these dogs that had been set upon him by the Israeli military sued Four Winds Canine Company and was paid substantial damages. You know, the company at the time said it was an expression of goodwill and it accepted no responsibility for the consequences of its actions. But you know, this again goes to show that the relationships, the genocidal relationships, if you will, between the West and Israel go far beyond, you know, supplying 2,000-pound bombs and casting vetoes at the UN Security Council. There is an entire matrix, a network of genocide that extends very deeply into the very marrows of Western states and its economies.
And you know, I know we have to wrap up here. And I think something I'd like to end on with you is the fact that, you know, since I last had you on, there's been an explosion of activism in the U.S. around this issue, even prior to the campus protests. But I think the campus protests, you know, that's the most recent phenomenon we've seen. We've also, in conjunction with that, had these anti-Semitism witch hunts, which have become more brutal than they were before October 7th, which I guess is to be expected. But all that said, you know, support for Israel in the U.S., especially among young people, has taken an existential hit for the Israelis, which is probably why their supporters are turning to, you know, bullying and these kind of legal attacks, these attacks on people's livelihoods, even using Congress to call people out by name to suppress pro-Palestine sentiment. Do you think this is a long-term problem for the Israelis and ultimately for the U.S.?
Yes, I do. First of all, these protests have been nothing short of extraordinary and extraordinarily inspiring, I should add. Secondly, I think there's a fundamental difference between a state like Israel, if you compare it, for example, to, I don't know, Saudi Arabia or Ivory Coast or any of these others. You know, for the others, for what matters is their relationships with the U.S. government and being able to ensure the continued support of U.S. government. And where U.S. public opinion figures into this is at best marginal. For Israel, the support of public opinion is a strategic asset of the first order. And it has always treated it that way. And to see Israel now no longer becoming an issue of bipartisan consensus in the U.S., but one that is increasingly feeding into the existing polarization, where Israel is increasingly identified with one part of the U.S. political spectrum and increasingly alienating itself from the other. And on top of that, where you have growing numbers of interested citizens, whether in the United States or Europe, and certainly in the UK as well, either no longer supporting Israel, becoming indifferent to it, or even becoming actively opposed to it. This is a strategic threat to Israel. And that is why Israel is treating it as such and responding to it as such. You know, I recently spoke with Norman Finkelstein, and I asked him if there was anything comparable to the kinds of witch hunts and firings and all the rest of it, and you know, students being expelled and faculty being hounded and you know, Ivy League university presidents being forced to resign. If there was anything similar during either the Vietnam War or during the Iraq War, distinction, of course, being that unlike the current situation, Vietnam and Iraq were both wars that the U.S. Was actively involved in. And his response was that there was nothing similar during either Vietnam or Iraq. You know, there may have been a few incidents here or there, but in terms of the level of repression and suppression we're currently seeing, it's of an entirely different and unprecedented level. And yes, you know, people are paying a cost. People are paying a significant cost, but they're not giving up. You know, they're continuing. And several academics I've spoken to expect the campus protests to erupt once again when the academic year starts in the fall, because of all the unresolved issues that have been left when the previous academic year ended at the beginning of the summer. And you know, so you look at all these extraordinary measures that Israel and its apologists and its flunkies and its supporters are taking, and what it demonstrates to be is not only the strategic significance of what's happening, but also that Israel recognizes that it has lost, that it is losing and it has lost, and that really the only quiver left in its arsenal is to resort to these sledgehammer tactics of congressional legislation, of you know, formal legal measures. If you have the public on your side, you don't resort to the law. You don't resort to official institutions to impose your perspective on the population. And you know, it shows also, I think, the growing schism between ruler and ruled, between government and the governed, in the West. And the fact that Israel and its apologists and its backers have to resort to these measures, I think, shows that the tide has turned, that we have turned a corner. And I believe that for Israel, there's no going back to the good old days where it could be all things to all people, and anyone and everyone would ultimately find what for them was a rational reason why they supported Israel in its battle with the Palestinians and the Arabs in the region.
Yeah, it really does reek of just absolute desperation. And I guess that's it. Maybe we can call that a positive note to end on. Ween, I want to thank you for joining me for the hour to break all this down. Can you please let everybody know where they can follow your work and your commentary?
Yes. Most of my work is available on Jedidiah, a website that I help co-edit. It's www.jedidiah.com. And I also do a weekly interview this week in Palestine, or this week from Palestine, with Nassim Ahmed of Middle East Monitor, that is broadcast on their website. And I also tend to post things on my Twitter account.
Yeah, your Twitter account is excellent. I encourage everybody to follow all of that. And I want to thank you for joining me, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Thank you, Rania. I look forward to it.
Again, you are listening to Dispatches with Rania Khalik and Muayyin Rabbani. This episode originally aired on July 17th, 2024. We are out of time, but I want to remind everybody that This Week in Palestine is released as a podcast every Tuesday on all major podcasting platforms. In the show notes for that podcast, you will have multiple links for Rania and Muayyin and additional information, as well as the slightly longer version of this interview. I did have to cut it down a bit to fit into our normal time slot. You can get the much longer version on the podcast. It takes a village to make a show like This Week in Palestine. Very special thanks to Stan Robinson and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Steve Lowe and Mohammed Al-Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.